That's why I'm
great seat.
That's good.
Thank you. And we'll open this hearing of the public informational meeting, I should say, for the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Services. Welcome, welcome. And we're going to start with an overview of the Oregon Emergency Management Program, and I'm going to let you folks orchestrate it. We gave the same to the Department of Veterans Affairs, the least that we can do.
How'd they do?
We're grading back here. We'll turn in our check sheets later.
I kind of want to know where they fell into the scheme. Of
You'd like to know
committee.
Where the bar is?
Yes,
is that
ma'am.
What you're looking
yes, ma'am.
For?
Yes, ma'am.
Way too long.
Please proceed.
Yes, ma'am.
Sir.
Thank you. I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity today to have our Division of Emergency Management come before you and give you an overview of emergency management. As a prelude, I wanted to just remind everybody that the 2007 legislative session moved the governor's request, moved the Emergency Management Office of Emergency Management over to the Oregon Military Department. In the last year and a half, we have had a good deal of activities to get into this in a big way, real quick, with a couple of fairly significant disasters, and not discounting the one we recently went through, and it's been a good experience at this point. There's still a lot that we all know we want to do in the department. We had great plans, and I've asked Paul to come up here and maybe just give a quick interview or overview from his perspective from the governor's office, but we prepared ourselves for this legislative session with a good deal of, we think, good ideas that would be help the state of Oregon in prepare itself and all local jurisdictions for emergencies. And unfortunately, the economy has worked against us in a great way, and we're fully aware of the fact that most of those good ideas are probably not going to see the light of day. Nevertheless, we're still plugging away, and we're still going to do what we can to keep you informed as representatives of a larger body, and hopefully downstream with consistency on your end, which we appreciate, people coming back year after year, session after session, so they have the history that's important for this body, and then hopefully we can keep advancing some of those things as money's available and as the time is right. But nevertheless, we're still having we really do appreciate the fact that emergency management is working with us now, and I think we've gotten over the rough spots rather quickly, and I would say that we have a fairly smooth operating system right now. Not to say that it can't be improved, and we're continually looking to do that, but certainly we've certainly enjoyed the last 18, 20 months, so, and working with Ken and his staff, so it's been a good move in our eyes. So I'll shut up. If Paul wants to say anything, let him go, and then we'll get to Ken.
Chair Cowan, members of the committee, I just wanted to emphasize the governor's support for the move from of Oregon Emergency Management under the military department. The governor likes having that synergy together, and we believe that a lot of progress has been made, and that in fact the December 2007 and December 2008 events went a lot better than they could have been, and that the progress being made right now is significant. Executive Order 0820 that was signed into
in your packet.
That's in your packet. That was put into place during the interim, emphasizes the governor's philosophy of the state's role during a time of disaster and that recovery process. Given the current state of the nation's finances, now more than ever, the state is responsible for things that we didn't always used to be responsible for. And I think the governor looks forward to the conversations and dialogue about building better systems to put in place, so that when we do have sessions with more resources available, we can invest in those approaches. So with that, I'm going to kind of freeze frame, hand over to Ken, and I'll be hanging back there if you have any questions. But I appreciate this opportunity before the body, and especially the hard work that you're doing.
Thank you, Chair Cowan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management. Couple comments by exception, just to go through this packet so you know what you have. On the left side of your packet, we have a little door hanger about being ready, Oregon. get a plan, make a kit, be informed, a little magnet to kind of remind you of the same thing. We also have in there a small book, which is an elected official's guide that we use with sheriffs, mayors, county commissioners, and it surely doesn't answer all of the questions, but gives them an idea of the process and some of the programs that are available out there so that they're somewhat familiar with the system. Behind that, you have the governor's executive order that Mr. Evans mentioned, 0820, that talks about the recovery framework. And then you also have a little 72-hour kit checklist. And this is just generic, recommended. Each person has to customize it for themselves and their family. And then finally, a two-page or a back-to-back document on some mitigation efforts that FEMA showcased that we'll talk a little bit more about in our presentation. And then also, as you well know, with the snowstorm that we had in December, we are working through the process now to put the figures together and to determine to put together a letter for the governor for a potential request for a presidential disaster declaration. If that does happen, Chair Cowan and I would hope the time allows that we maybe can either brief the committee or have them come out to the federal joint field office, which will be located here in Salem, and you can see a lot of this in excruciating detail, but a good briefing on what's going on in the counties that would be declared a disaster. And I'll keep the committee posted on that.
Please do.
Okay. I will try and be as brief as I can. There's a tremendous amount of information that we can talk about in here, and I will just highlight some of the issues and things that I want to make sure that you're well aware of. And, of course, any more detail I'll be more than happy to provide. This opening slide is the mission statement that's found in ORS 401, and it's, I think, a very good one, which I believe allows the military department and my office to really take advantage of every single business, every public and private organization in the state, visitors to the state of Oregon, to try and make sure that they're safe and engaged in case we do have a disaster or things they should be prepared for during a disaster. Second one is a good eye chart, and I can provide you more detail if you're interested. The ones in yellow are the people located in Pendleton, Oregon, where is my second office, which is the Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness Program, which we will talk about further in the slides. The rest of the organization is located in Salem at the National Guard facility called the Anderson Readiness Center on State Street, just down from the prison and the lottery, right at the corner of State and Hawthorne.
How exactly would you put more detail on this slide? You said it.
Chair Cowan, I'm surprised you would ask me that.
I'm sorry. This is my favorite slide that he has.
Yeah. I remind you, 29 years in the Oregon Guard, and I do have numerous awards for PowerPoint presentations, so I could add more. And I know that's a lot, but it's there for your reference so that you can kind of see how the organization is put together. Next, I want to take you through the disaster cycle. Currently, there are 12 steps. On the slide that you have, you can see all 12 that is there. And I'm just going to bring these all up so we don't belabor it and just roughly talk through each one of those. Step number one is always, I think, one of the most important steps. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the slides as we go through them, but that's the non-emergency period where we as a state, every level of government, public and private and citizen level, is working on any type of mitigation programs, any type of preparedness activities, so that we can do as much as we can across our state to make sure that our communities and our citizens and the visitors to the state of Oregon are as best prepared as we possibly can. Step two, obviously, the disaster strikes. Step three is when the local government responds, saves lives, protects property. They activate their local emergency operations center. their disaster plans that are put in place, and that's when they notify through the chain of command, through the county, up to the state level at my office, that this city or this county has activated and are doing certain events, you know, in the process of the disaster. And, of course, requesting mutual aid, as we talked about at one of our earlier committee hearings with neighboring jurisdictions, and expending resources in the effort to do what they can to save lives and protect property and make sure that the citizens are safe and secure. As you go to step four, we're notifying state agencies at my office. We have about 22 to 66 agencies that I would call the usual suspects that have the most resources, the most individuals, and those type of things that need to be notified if there's something of great magnitude that's going on. And in most all cases, we always surely notify, you know, the National Guard, the Oregon Department of Transportation, and then the Department of Human Services, and also the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services, because generally speaking, those three agencies have some sort of role in it. And then we have different levels of standby at the Emergency Coordination Center. We have an executive duty officer that's on 24/7, 365. We rotate that in our office, and then we can activate full up, running 24/7. And we have a 24/7 answering point, very similar to a 911 center, all it's only internal to government. So calls will come in there, and it's called the Oregon Emergency Response System, which we'll talk a little bit more briefly as we go on. And then we go to step five. As most of you know, if the disaster is beyond the capabilities or the resources are expended, then the declaration process begins with a request for assistance, and the county will provide their resources, and likewise, if they can't, then the declaration slowly works up, and part of that is providing certain amount of analysis and documentation to support the request so that we can properly help the communities across the state. And step six, we declare an emergency. This is what we've done over the last few storms that have taken place. Portions of our Emergency Coordination Center are activated depending on how much is needed to support it. And we provide state assistance as requested or what we can bring to bear from other agencies, city, county, across the state to help local communities. Step seven really is the next level, as it is in the city and county level and the state level. If we've expended our resources or it's too big and overwhelming, we can request federal assistance. And there's many, many different versions of this request, which is a more detailed discussion at a later date if the committee desires. But as I mentioned earlier, we're in the process now of making a draft for the governor to look at to request federal declaration for the snow. And part of that, again, is the analysis and documentation. FEMA has been in town the last 2 weeks working with our communities across primarily the northwestern and central part of the state on damage assessments, validating figures, that type of thing, which is required to be in the letter that goes through our regional Federal Emergency Management Agency offices in Bothell, Washington, and then on to the federal government in Washington, D.C. for analysis before they sign off on it. And then also, usually before step seven, but step seven for sure, the governor's recovery framework can be or is implemented depending on what the issues are. And obviously, we're keeping Mr. Evans and those people fully involved, and we have call down lists and things like that to get the governor's recovery cabinet up and moving, depending on what the issues are that we have to deal with this. And I think this is a great tool. You know, I'm very proud of what the governor and the governor's office did with this, and I think it paid some big dividends in the December 2007 storm, and is still paying dividends to this day. Step eight, really the federal emergency management comes to town. That's really what that is about. They implement the national response framework, which is really a framework of describing how the federal government works with local communities before, during, and after disaster. And they set up a joint field office here in Salem, and it can be anywhere from 60 to 100 to 300 people, depending on how large it is and what are the requirements of the state in support of the cities and the counties across the state. And there is a state coordinating officer appointed and then a federal coordinating officer appointed. And those are really the two points where decisions are made. They're done in tandem. They work together as a team, making decisions that are, number one, legal, but what is best for the citizens of the state of Oregon in processing the claims. And you'll note, too, that there's another individual that can be appointed by the President and the Secretary of Homeland Security called the Principal Federal Official. And that has been used during hurricanes, but generally and somewhat predicated in how you interpret federal law is used for terrorist attacks only. And that is a person that would represent the President and the Secretary of Homeland Security so they can have direct conversations on what is actually going on in a terrorist event. And then 9 and 10, really coordinating the efforts of the federal, state, county, and city response efforts, taking care of, obviously, the threat to life and property and making sure that the citizens are safe, secure, they have the basic needs that are required if the event is still going on. And then as you go into 11, really, you're managing the damages, you're working with the communities, filling out paperwork on how to mitigate and how to put back the things that have been destroyed or broken that are eligible for federal assistance. And I might add, normally federal assistance is usually 75% federal money and 25% state/local money. Very rarely, such as Hurricane Katrina, the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, D.C., will you get to the 100% federal money or even 90% federal and 10% local. Those really raise to the catastrophic level of events. And then 12, as always, modify lessons learned, take the time to review what went right, what went wrong, and try and improve our system as we do across the state. A few relevant statutes that I wanted to bring up. The role of local government, as you can see cited, that the preparations for emergencies and governmental responsibility for responding to emergencies is placed at the local level. Trying to make sure that we work with the local level in any way we can to help give them the tools, if at all possible, either financially or resources, to do what we can to make sure that they're ready at the local level to deal with things, and that's the cities and the counties. And then the next one, 401.305, each county in this state shall and each city may establish an emergency management program. Let me define why the word shall and may are in there. Shall is because we give counties money. I can't give them an unfunded mandate, and that's why it says may for cities. Now, many cities across the state of Oregon have put into place an emergency management office and hired a person, or they have a volunteer working. But we do fund each county, or some counties, not always, depending on their situation, but we do provide funding for a portion of the salary for an emergency manager at the county level. And I thought an interesting note that I always like at the very bottom, and this is also in statutes, is where the governor can assume authority over a jurisdiction depending on certain circumstances. But as you can see, if the response is beyond the capability of the city or county fails to act, or the emergency involves two or more counties. And that is in there, and I think primarily if your local elected officials are a victim, they're not there, something is wrong, that we can move in and help, to take over and keep things running to ensure the continuity of government and the safety of citizens.
Could I stop you for just a second?
Yes.
There? I think it might be important to note that, yes, you could step in if you needed to, but this is the structure that's in place. and the reason around some of that conversation that we had as we debriefed after the storm in terms of who declares an emergency and or requests the emergency declaration and that kind of thing. It's structured in statute, and it also allows for that coordination between local government and state.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that fair
sure.
to say?
Yeah, it's fair to say. In statute, there's a pretty well detailed structure of how the process works. And I freely admit I don't know some of the background when this law was initiated, but you could have, and I'll just give you a couple examples, you could have a city or a county or even something where the jurisdiction is just destroyed. The people are dead. You take a look at Katrina or Hurricane Ike and Gustav, where whole cities were wiped off the map. The town in Kansas that was destroyed from the tornado. And this is one of the potentials where, state government can come in and work, if the jurisdiction's government is gone and the people aren't there. And then also you have to take into account if a county fails to act. I think that was put in there probably just to make sure that if for some reason they fail to act, that we can come in there and keep the process running and help the jurisdiction to be able to survive. Going through some of these, and I surely will not belabor each one of these points. Some of them are very obvious. I will just highlight a couple areas that I think is important. Both the Oregon Military Department and the Office of Emergency Management are members of the State Interoperability Executive Council, so we have been involved with the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network and the whole process of dealing with interoperability. I know I've been a member of that committee since its inception, I think, in 2002, and so we're full partners and members at the table dealing with all of the issues of interoperability with all the members of that council.
And the committee is scheduled to get an update on that on Thursday as to where that project is.
Yes. Okay. Also, the Governor's Homeland Security Council.
Could we interrupt with a question?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Just very brief. Thank you, Chair Cowan. So on these pages, you have four personnel. So four people oversee all these different...
Chair Cowan and Representative Comp... I would say that we not, let me just take an example. Oversee is probably not the word that, in all fairness, I wouldn't say I oversee the Interoperability Executive Council, but we are either overseeing or we're an integral part of a council or a region or something like that, where we play an integral part. And the reason I put it under there is because the director's office, both myself and my deputy, John Sneed, go to the meetings and sit on it, and we deal with the actions that council works with.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
You bet. The Governor's Homeland Security Council, that was created in legislation in 2007, and that is a large group of people that represent all jurisdictions that we deal with and discuss Homeland Security related material, but also it does talk about natural disasters and things. We try and take a holistic approach in looking at all things that affect the citizens of Oregon. We've talked about the Governor's Recovery Cabinet and the Oregon Public Affairs team, it wasn't that many years ago, and we did not have a public affairs person in Oregon Emergency Management, and we were very fortunate to finally get one, and I think it's made a huge difference in the ability to have somebody dealing with the issues at working with county public affairs officers, and the person that we have, in fact, she's here today, her name's Jennifer Bailey. And she put together a public affairs team for disasters where we beg, borrow, and steal from other state agencies and put together teams of public information officers to deal with disasters and if we ultimately have to set up a joint information center or something becomes very large. And so I think it goes without saying how important the media affairs are of any disaster. And so I know... for many years, we never had a public affairs person that always kind of fell under my job description, and means a lot to me to have that capabilities.
And the pictures are prettier that we now have in our presentation.
Yeah, I wasn't that very good at pictures. A couple other things I just want to highlight. The Pacific Northwest Emergency Management Arrangement, that is an arrangement with Washington, Oregon, Alaska, Idaho, British Columbia, and the Yukon. And that's something that we've had in place. It's been approved by Congress, and it's also been ratified by our legislature. In fact, in 2008, we had made some amendments to that and was ratified by the legislature. And we take the approach that disasters don't recognize lines, countries, and the problems we all face, no matter what jurisdiction you're in or what country, are the same. So this is a group of emergency managers representing the two countries, the four states, the province, and the territory, working on issues that are common to all of us. And it also is very beneficial, as you well know, as we come up on the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver, British Columbia, that we're all working very closely together in an effort to make sure that that Olympic event goes off without a hitch, and that the people are safe that are going to enjoy that venue. Pacific Northwest Economic Region, very similar, but it adds on some different states and territories. I'm not even going to try and recite them all, but it's a group headquartered out of Seattle, Washington, and they work together to try and look at the economics of our region, both in southern Canada and western the United States, and how we're all connected, whether it's electricity, water, trade routes, different types of transportation, working to try and address the issues of how we can do a better job. And if something happens, like Interstate 5 being flooded in Washington State and the east-west passages in Washington State being closed because of snow, what happens to the economics of the area, and how could we figure out a way to fix those things? So it's a really good group of people, a lot of very smart people, both public and private, working those issues. Pacific Coast Collaborative is relatively new. This is something that the governors of California, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and British Columbia put together, and it had emergency management in its charter, which I was humble and happy to see. But it's working on many issues, environmental, ocean issues, fishery issues, but emergency management. And we've not had much interreaction right now, but again, I think, again, the problems are common to our region, and it's a good group to work with. Critical infrastructure programs is very similar to what I talked about in the economic regions, and that's really taking a look at critical infrastructure in Oregon, how we deal with dams and hydroelectric and electricity and water and all of those type of things. And there's also a portion of that dealing with those pieces of critical infrastructure as defined by the Department of Homeland Security and how we manage those. The next one is the technology and response programs. As you can see, 911 is in there, where they provide the assistance, the portions of the money collected on the telephone tax to ensure that equipment and 911 centers are up and operational across the state. Also, 211 is a system. I did on purpose put in there, it's not funded. They do have some funding that they've gained themselves. It is in ORS 401 charging my office to seek funding, which I have not been successful at, to make that a full-fledged system in Oregon. It's a health and human services line to really deal with during non-emergencies and during emergencies, to take the pressure off of the 911 system when people are just wanting to know where to go to get a shot, maybe where the local food stamp offices, or human service type of issues that many people have questions, and especially during disasters, there's a certain amount of disorientation and things are confused, and so I think this is a very important piece that we have. Search and rescue coordination at the state level, as you know or don't know, it's the responsibility of the county sheriffs at the local level for search and rescue, and our office deals with coordination at the state level for state level and or federal assets. Next one I want to briefly mention is the amateur radio program. After the December 2007 storm, when the North Coast communications were totally cut off, everything, even satellite didn't work. The amateur radio program worked. And thanks to Governor Kulongowski and Mr. Paul Evans and everybody working really hard, we were given $250,000 to buy enough to put brand new equipment in every county. And we're working on other entities to put this in. We've been working also with public health to look at putting them in hospitals. And this is state-of-the-art, brand new digital, improved some of the antennas. And with this type of equipment, you can do pretty much everything you can do on a computer over an amateur radio. So it's a great tool, and we're in the process of placing them across the state. Many of them have been in place. Training has been conducted, so this will be a capability at each county in the state of Oregon. And then also the Governor's Search and Rescue Policy Commission, as you I'm sure have heard, after the James Kim case and also the hikers on Mount Hood a few years ago, the governor put together a blue ribbon panel and a task force to address those issues. And then since that time, after that task force had came forth with its recommendations, the governor went on then to make a permanent Search and Rescue Policy Commission to continue to work those issues to make our search and rescue system better in the state. Next one is our plans and training section. Again, very obvious. I will say the Department of Homeland Security grants, this is where those grants, the accounting part is not necessarily managed in that area, but the program pieces are of dealing with the grant guidance, making sure that we're buying the right things in coordination with the accounting personnel, and that we're using that money to improve our capabilities in the case of a terrorist attack. But I think most of you know if some of the things that are done in the name of Homeland Security will also help us during natural disasters too, and I think that's what's something as important as we use taxpayers' dollars, whether at any level of government, that we're going to get the most credible use in what we need to do to protect citizens.
I don't know if you had the opportunity yesterday to go out and see what was out in front of the Capitol, but there was several of the local sheriffs, county sheriffs had their equipment in. The majority of that was purchased under this grant program, where they have their mobile CPs and other interesting pieces of equipment. And I would say that probably 90-95% of that was purchased through this program.
Spent a lot of money in that area.
Very good Thank equipment.
You. Also, you can see the training, planning, and exercise. We just simply try, based on our staffing and money available, to do as much of that of every level of government we can. We also, under this shop, have the Emergency Coordination Center and managing it and running it, the earthquake, volcano, and tsunami programs in dealing with jurisdictions across the state. And then we have, as I mentioned earlier, the Oregon Emergency Response System, 24/7, 365, located at the Anderson Readiness Center. But due to some law enforcement laws, it's currently housed under OSP. But it's something that really is part of our organization, has been ever since it was created, I think, in 1972. And it is our first place when that first phone call comes in saying something's wrong or broken or whatever the issue may be. We also, with that, have an Oregon Emergency Response Council that's made up of many different partners, and we go through and trying to make sure that we understand what we're doing as far as response and doing a better job at it and looking at statistics and issues and training those people on that council on what we're going to have to deal with based on any particular situation. We also have the Seismic Safety Policy Commission, and then the State Preparedness, Domestic Preparedness Working Group, that's really working on the, you know, street level issues of domestic preparedness and homeland security to improve it across the state. And our financial and recovery programs, very simply, they take care of the financial issues and the accounting issues at the state and federal level, dealing with all the different programs. Disaster recovery programs, we could spend a whole nother committee hearing because there's some really great programs in here that people can take advantage of across our state, and we have over the years. And this is, as you can see by some of the photos, this is really, we really start doing things that protect communities and protect individual homeowners for future disasters. The Natural Hazard Mitigation Program is a great one. I can tell you that over time we've spent almost as much money on mitigating things in this state as we have bought Homeland Security things. And, you know, if you ever want to know, maybe in your particular district, we keep very detailed lists. And I know down in Chair Cowan's area, you know, about half the homes on the Siletz River is elevated, and we got our eye on the other half because we know what's going to happen. And so I think, you know, it's a very important program, and you can really see benefits from that. I mean, I can't tell you how many homeowners and business owners can tell you the difference between when it flooded and after you elevated it, what the difference was. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Has there been any thought of doing that with Tillamook, with the Dairy Queen and everything that's down there, because having a house in Neatarts and family that lives in Tillamook seems, you know, it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. I mean, it's there all the time, but we just keep digging out the Chevy dealership, and it's...
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It's almost insanity the way we keep doing it over and over when we'd be cheaper for us to just take their building and build them a new building up on top.
Yeah, absolutely. Chair Cowan, Representative Wiener, we, believe me, everybody in my office, everybody in Tillamook County Emergency Management, we have that section of Highway 101 targeted and bracketed by building, trying to do it. But we cannot force a private business to move. At least I haven't found a legal way to do it.
Zip on about three pages.
Yeah.
Ahead.
I would think their insurance company wouldn't like it too awful much.
Right there.
Yeah, and, you know, and I'll tell you, Safeway is a great example. Every single year, they would lose at a minimum of $5 million in groceries and stuff that's in their store. And my office and the people that work on that and the planning department in Tillamook and Tillamook County, I mean, meeting to ad nauseum to convince them to move. We finally did, and we truly do work with each one of them constantly. And I'm hopeful that someday we will get it all. But it's going to take some time, and I wish we could convince businesses, and I think, as you can see on this particular slide, we need to take advantage of, if you look at this Northport Plaza, we need to take the owner of that Northport Plaza and walk them down to the car dealership and have a cup of coffee and talk. Although I will say, in the case of the car dealership there on 101, they have a great emergency response plan to call in all the people to move the cars once they know the water's coming, because right now they're unwilling to give up that retail spot. And but you can see just this picture here of the Northport Plaza. We finished that, not we, the contractor, 6 weeks before the December 07 flood. And that Northport Plaza has businesses in it, and I can guarantee you every one of them would have been destroyed and probably not recovered from the event. And it was raised, and you can see the bottom picture there. As soon as the water receded, they were open for business within, you know, just a day or two. And the same thing with the Western Royal Inn. You know, you couldn't get to it with the high water, but immediately they were available to house people, especially if the Red Cross was moving a family after the flood. And I wished I had a better answer for you on it. We just keep trying to work very hard with them to convince them, you know, that there are obviously there's issues with the economy and the retail location of that particular portion of Highway 101. And as you can see by the slide, for every $1 invested in mitigation, you can get a $4 return. And but it's just something we have to keep working with them and convince them.
Director.
Yes, ma'am.
Why don't we go ahead with Rep. Boom first? And then
I just wanted to mention the fact that there's been the last couple of years an Oregon Solutions project around the flooding issue, and they've identified the first, I guess, 9 or 10 projects, and they've got 2 in now. One's done, one's almost finished, and the first one does show that it's working, and what these are doing is helping to mitigate some of the flood waters so that the levels are not so high. And it's directing it to where and there's plans being made for addressing different pieces of the area. That was a very large group of local people who met on a regular basis with a facilitator and all the agency people and the emergency people, and they agreed on, and they got some funding for a very small amount of funding, but it was really well used, and it's working, and we just have a lot of hope, 2 out of 2 working, well, 1.5 working. I know the second one's going to work, and then the rest of them will help this a lot. And then what Director Murphy has said about getting people to consider the elevation, it's been a godsend, and plus the early warning system that they've used. And even in 2007, was it 5 or 7, we implemented the emergency action to address animal movement. Was that 5 or 7? Right after.
I think that was in 7.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
And that was utilized, too. It's being utilized, hit and miss, but much more so, and not so many animals were lost in the last flood.
One thing that reminds me, and General Caldwell just mentioned, actually, this was from 96 floods, but the invention of cow pads.
Mm-hmm. They are a godsend.
Yeah, it's just basically a big mound of dirt elevated about 15 to 20 feet in the air, and you get the cows up there, and you don't lose your dairy herd.
They do look a little strange.
They do.
All is dry, but we did learn a great deal from the 96 floods. And if you could go, let's see, in your presentation, be back one, another direction, again. There we go. Those are the pictures that I was wanting to refer to, and maybe to elaborate on this discussion. Every area is really unique, and certainly Tillamook County has some real unique features around prime location in terms of business location any other time of the year and how they need to do with it. But maybe you could elaborate a little on the insurance incentive in order to get the FEMA flood mitigation or flood insurance. There are some requirements after an event that you do mitigation on your home, and that was the reason I asked you to go to this slide. I think one of those, at least that upper right-hand corner, is along the Sillettes, I believe. But
it is.
In Lincoln County, the segment along the Sillettes River, along Highway 229, is also a unique geographical area and one that floods consistently. And when you drive that road right now, you see a bunch of houses that look like that, and they're really silly-looking houses sometimes, unless you've lived through 96 and several of those other events. Much of what prompted that to happen was in order to get flood insurance.
Flood insurance and the rates.
And to get good rates, there had to be mitigation done. And I can tell you firsthand from Lincoln County's emergency manager's perspective, he got all of the nasty phone calls when people were told that they needed to do some mitigation efforts in order to get this insurance coverage. And then they called back after the next flood to say, thank you for making me do that. My house survived.
Yeah. And Chair Cowan is absolutely correct. You do in these cases, number one, a jurisdiction has to have a good mitigation plan. And the reason I say that is because if you want more money from the federal government, you have to have a good one and an approved one from FEMA. And the difference can range from 7.5% of a disaster's total dollars up to an approved, enhanced, well, an approved plan of 20%. Those are big differences in dollars. And these dollars are then used to do these type of mitigation effects, buyouts, elevations, which then affects the community's rating for these flood insurances. And you can well imagine when you tell a homeowner that you've got to elevate 8, 10, 12 feet, you know, it's you know, these are not exactly Sunset Home pictures, Sunset Magazine pictures, but once they've experienced the flood after it's elevated and they see what they don't lose, to include, you know, not only their personal belongings, but their livelihood, it really makes a huge difference. I mean, you talk about, you know, somebody that can sell the program, but it is difficult that very first time, you know, when their home is either gone or floating down the river or totally destroyed, to sit there and talk about, well, let's elevate next time. And you have to obviously work very closely with each family and there, but I always like this picture in the upper left column there where the gentleman is holding his hand, and you can see where the water came up and how much different it made with that elevation. And one of the things, too, I'll just mention on this slide, you can see the house burning. That's probably a misleading photo, but a lot of times, depending on where the buyouts are, you know, if we know an area is going to be truly repetitively flooding, very bad, then, you know, we give options where people can actually sell their home, and we turn spaces into parks or greenways. In this case, they donate them to the fire department to practice training to putting out fires.
And I thought that was somebody who refused to elevate.
So was just gonna, yeah.
Please,
that's
please.
Why I
local government
an explanation in there really quick.
We'll show you how the game's played, huh?
Yeah, but and I tried, you know, we said earlier, I'm not very good at pictures. I have a great picture I just can't find of the city of Nehalem, and we elevated that city. It's not a big city. It's got to start somewhere. You know, and it really, Mayor Shirley Calcoban down there is just a great advocate for these type of things. And it really makes a difference when, especially businesses and the livelihood, tourism being one of those key issues, you know. And if you drive through the city there, you'll see all this lattice work underneath the porches, and that's just hiding the cement or the wood or the steel pillars that elevate, you know. And you can't move the whole city, but you surely know that river every year in some way, shape, or form is going to come up and destroy that community. And so we prevented that, and pretty proud of that one.
Sorry, we're no, that's, all over in your
that's
presentation,
fine.
But
that's
we'll
fine.
Let you get back on track.
I think probably really on here, this shop, the financial and recovery programs, really, you know, their greatest work is the mitigation efforts and then the recovery efforts, because they are working with communities and citizens to either mitigate or help them recover, you know, to bring back that person's life, their home, the business, whatever the case, in the counties and the city's infrastructure, and dealing with it. And so it's very rewarding, and we work a lot with planning departments at the city and county level and many other organizations.
I might add just in here that one of the things that I think was kind of a shock to us when we took over the agency was that these folks are running open disasters that are 5 and 6 years old. So they're still doing work from 5, 6, 7 years ago, because FEMA still has them open, and they've got to conclude that and do all the paperwork, and may take that long for somebody to get their particular problem solved and or houses elevated. And
environmental.
So environmental,
historical,
you name it. So they do a full spectrum, and they deal with these things long, long after that we've all moved on, and we're dealing with a new disaster, a new thing, and they're still dealing with something 5, 6 years ago. So I was, when we first looked at that, I said, I couldn't believe it. I said, why are they still working on something that's 8 years old? And they said, because they're not closed yet. Mm-hmm. They've still got issues out there. So.
Yep. two last points on that slide. The State Interagency Hazard Mitigation Team, this is a collection of state agencies working together to have a state mitigation plan. And again, we have to have one approved by FEMA, and we have to renew it. It's not something you can just write and put in a 3-inch binder and forget. It has to be constantly renewed, and you can add to it and get an enhanced level, which gets you more money. And just very briefly, when a disaster strikes and you get X amount of dollars from the federal government, a certain percentage of that money is then set aside for mitigation. Hazard mitigation is the name of the program, and that's where you can go in and work on these projects to elevate or put a bigger culvert in a road instead of a smaller culvert, or whatever the case may be, to lessen the impact in the future. And then Partners for Disaster Resistance and Resilience, that's just a great program with the University of Oregon and other educational institutions, and they help us through their students and with going out and working with communities, students that are getting a degree in planning or whatever the case may be, and they work with these communities on different effects, but for sure the mitigation plans, and that's been a great partnership that's gone on for years. Where did I wanted to show you this as another great example. Western Oregon Electric is always in the news because of where it's located. It provides electrical service to a portion of Oregon that's heavily timbered. And one of the greatest problems to electrical companies is, as you well know, the wires being brought down or the poles brought down by high wind. But in the case of this, it's trees. And this has happened across Oregon for many years. And one of the mitigation programs that we use, the hazard mitigation dollars from disasters, is putting together projects as much as we can to bury power lines underground. We know that we can't necessarily fix all the tree problems, so we're attempting to fix it from another angle. And this just kind of gives you an idea where we're combining projects. You can see with ODOT putting help in a rest area with a generator. We're working with Western Oregon Electric to begin burying power lines, hopefully be done by the end of this year, and we'll end up with about 14.42 miles that we'll never have to worry again. And we have many examples of electrical companies in the state of Oregon where we've done this and never had a single problem once it's buried underground. Yes?
May we stop you there for a bit of a question? Could you give us a little history about how you reached this plan of improvement, and what I'm specifically thinking about now? In the hearing, we talked about the loss of 911 services in Lincoln City during the last storm, which seems to be related, as we work through that whole problem, to problems with the power lines in a particular stretch from about Sheridan to Grand Ronde. So I'd be interested in a little more information on how you got to this project, how we might think about moving another one.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I'll get you that information. But the quick answer is this: state interagency hazard mitigation team. We've taken it, and we've taken the hazards that face Oregon: flooding, severe winters, fire, earthquakes, volcanoes. We have a mitigation plan for all of those, and we try and have a well-documented plan that shows what the issues are, what projects that we can do to mitigate those effects. And so I will get you that information, and we can talk more about that, because the public utilities, they're involved in our plan, and many other organizations for that fact, and how we can mitigate against anything and everything. But we actually have to come up with concrete plans that are implementable. Now, you can't just talk about it. You got to have an actual plan with steps and actions that has to be implemented, and that's why it makes it a very valuable document to FEMA, because it's something, if the money is there, it's ready to go with a little bit of coordination. But
thank you. This may not be the exact direction, but as you talk about the potential,
for there being FEMA involvement in this last storm. I think that's an area that I, at least on this committee, would be interested in some follow-up of what came out of our debrief hearing as to kind of a hanging issue there that we don't see a solution for.
Yeah, because I think, you know, as is the state of Oregon and the counties and the cities, and it's for sure FEMA, you know, with this money that's set aside for hazard mitigation, the intent, and, you know, we always want more money, but the intent is to try and lessen the impacts of future disasters, and that's why they put that type of importance on that, that, you know, here are the things that we can do, you know, to try and lessen it. We can't stop it in most cases, but we can reduce the impacts through one of these different methods of mitigation for the future. And so I will get you some more information. We can talk more about that.
Thank you.
Last, the Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness Program. I will not belabor this. It's simply the destruction of wartime agents used for the purpose of war. They are stored around numerous locations in the United States and also Russia and other places, and this is a treaty with Russia to destroy these chemical weapons. Oregon has one of those depots located split down the middle of Morrow and Umatilla counties. Interesting how I'm sure that was a plan, but the county line goes right down the middle of the depot. Bottom line is, and I will not read that, it's a great program. It's totally funded by the federal government to have a program that protects the citizens and the communities in that area that can be affected based upon the scientific data of wind and many different elements where a chemical could go. And so it also includes Benton County, Washington, just below the Tri-Cities, and the tribe, the Confederated Tribe there. And it's been a great program, but it is coming to an end, which is good news. The incinerator is working effectively and efficiently, and as you can see there right now, it's scheduled to terminate somewhere between the spring and late 2010. If nothing goes wrong with the destruction process or mechanical processes of the incinerator, it will cease in the spring of 2010, and then they go through a closeout program. And so we've already been working at every level of government with the Eastern Oregon counties that are affected in dealing with some of the issues, well, not some of the issues, but all of the issues, to make sure that we're well identified and how we're going to close this out. Now, we really have to worry about close out on the outside of the fence of the Army depot. On the inside of the fence, is that belongs to the Army. And that incinerator, by treaty, is to be destroyed. $1 billion incinerator, and it'll be rubbled, I think is the correct term. I did want to mention in here, we did spend money a few years back on putting a nice new 450 megahertz radio system in that area. And you might or probably will see one of the legislators here in the state come forward to put together a potential special district of some sort to be able to take over that communication system. We've also been working with Mr. Lindsey Ball, who heads up the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, to see what we can share, use to help the Owen project, because it also has towers, and we already have state police and other entities on those towers, but we've been working with the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network to make sure that we're not overlooking anything, and that this will support, I think there's 14 towers, if I remember correctly, out there. Some are on the Washington side of the river, to make sure it supports Owen, and then this will support the local jurisdictions in their day-to-day public safety duties once they get everything put together to put together some sort of special district.
Representative Boone.
Yes. Has there been any additional activity or new activity on utilizing or recycling that incinerator for garbage disposal?
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, I am not familiar with anything. I know it's been talked about. Gosh, why should we tear this thing down?
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, the local reuse authority, it was established right after, I think it was the 8th of January. And what that process is, it's a federal process by, dictated by Congress that says that you've got to bring in all the stakeholders and you've got to decide what's going to happen to the base after the Army closes it down. And they've declared it excess, so they are going to get rid of it. We're a player in that, the National Guard is, because we train there. We train on the base even now with the incinerator there. We have made a request through the Army, through our channels, suggesting that there are usable facilities that they, as Ken indicated, have planned to tear down, to include, you know, mess halls, administrative buildings, classrooms, things that storage facilities, shops, and all of that is scheduled to be demolished. And we have made a request to say we think that needs to be reconsidered because if we can't use it, somebody can. As far as the incinerator goes, there has been numerous suggestions made that that ought to be left intact for future use. But unless there's a change in the congressional language, and I think Ken's correct when he says the treaty requires that the incinerator itself be demolished, and I think there's also federal law that requires that because of the fear of having some of these chemical residues remaining in that, and therefore it would be unsafe for the public. So I would, if I was a betting man, I would bet that the incinerator itself will be dismantled piece by piece. Now, whether or not the support facilities, we're trying to make them, you know, like I said, make a play for the Army to leave them and get the LRA to put that in their recommendation, and perhaps they'll still remain, some of those big support buildings. But the incinerator itself, I'm almost certain, will be gone.
Follow up. If there's anything that we can do to facilitate that, especially the facilities where there's dorms, mess hall, and a place where disaster victims could be moved in the case of when the big earthquake comes or a tsunami or something, for housing, temporary housing.
The current main post, which is basically World War II era with modifications, you know, over the last 60 years, has some limited ability to, you know, for barracks and that sort of thing, which we currently use, like I said. But they're pretty Spartan. I mean, they're a pretty Spartan operation. I think the locals are going to want to see economic development. They got visions of major hubs there. Walmart, for instance, has a 30-40 acre warehouse transfer station not too far from there now. And I think they see where all the connectivity comes from, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, right there in that hub, that there is some economic development potential there. So I think it's going to, you know, this process has got to take place. The governor's office is involved in it. There's several watchful eyes on it. What was fascinating was in 1981, when we first went onto that post, we were told, well, don't get too familiar here because this thing will be shut down in about 5 years. So that's what the Army told us. So I guess they missed. So who knows how long this will go. So
okay, let's
let me get to the chemical stockpile. Just two more quick comments. I do have my dibs on the sirens to move them to the Oregon coast for tsunamis. Shamelessly, Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, Tillamook County has already submitted a letter asking for all the sirens. So.
Well, we may have to talk about that.
Yeah.
One every
just,
4 feet.
Just don't destroy a radio system like that, please.
Yeah, no, I'm very hopeful that we will do the right thing between the jurisdictions there and the state, that we make full use of that system. And the other thing I want to mention, we've gotten used to this federal money. I'll be the first to tell you, it's funded quite a few things for Oregon Emergency Management, and it's going away. We have some employees here in Salem that are currently funded by that, and I will be back probably in the 2011 legislative cycle asking for support on that, because we do have many programs that I desire to keep moving that are currently funded by the chemical stockpile program.
Where they have overlap and they work together. Yeah.
Last slide is just some issues that I wanted to bring to your attention that I think are important, and one of the most important things to me, as it is in my mission statement, really, is to do everything I can to help the state of Oregon, and it's primarily the local jurisdictions in doing whatever we can to improve them and us to be prepared for disasters or respond and recover better for them. These two particular issues did not make it, but I think it's important to bring them up. One is improving National Guard facilities on a regional basis. I think it's really important when we already have facilities like the National Guard armories in our communities to do what we can to make those, if you will, safe havens or islands unto themselves that would have their separate water source, power generation, the capability to put different people in them to work as a team. And I think that is very important that we have those kind of capabilities across this state on a regional basis. And then along with that is another package dealing with regional people belonging to my office that are out there supporting local and county emergency managers. There isn't a day doesn't go by that there isn't a city or a county, especially the counties, that need help with stuff, and this is just more tools that we could bring to bear to help out at any time. And then the last one is the disaster fund. It's clear that, you know, we need to do everything. This is one more tool in our toolkit, but I think it's really an important one to talk about. During a disaster, if you have a presidentially declared disaster, as I mentioned a couple times, there's a 25% match requirement. That has to come from a city or county coffers. You know, and that's very tough to deal with. And that was tough before these economic times. And it's got to be very tough. And some of that, you know, can obviously be dealt in different ways. And then there's also the reverse of that. When a presidential disaster declaration isn't declared and a city or county or jurisdiction is out the money and we can't help in some way, shape, or form. And I think we'll see some stories that have come out of the last couple of years. I can think of a couple that have come out of Christmas and New Year's snow and flooding that, you know, the communities are don't have the money to pay for some of the things that were broken or destroyed. And I think it's something that I feel compelled to keep talking about, that we owe our jurisdictions and our citizens. And also, the tough part about this is a steady and continuous funding source. We were given money out of the general fund after the December 2007, and it needs to be something other than the general fund, obviously, but and there's many things that you can do with these funds. If it's not being used for a disaster, you can take a portion of it to pay for mitigation projects. So there's, I think, many, many benefits here, and I hope as we go through the process, you know, that one of these days we'll be able to figure this one out where we can do something that will help these communities. Doesn't happen every day, but when it does happen, it's very tough to look them in the eye and tell them no, can't help you.
That concludes my briefing. Thank you. Do you happen to know off the top of your head what dollar amount was attached to the two policy option packages that you mentioned here?
I'm not going to guess, Madam Chair, but I will get you that information before the close of business today.
Well, it doesn't have to be quite that quick, but we might...
Well, we usually have that in our back pockets.
It might be helpful to have some of that information as the committee proceeds. And while you're at it, we'll add to the list of things any creative thinking that has been done internally about perhaps a potential alternate source of funding for some kind of a disaster recovery fund would be enjoyable to entertain. We are all truly schooled about what to ask for and what not to ask for from the general fund this year. And just one last question on that disaster fund. Coming from a local jurisdiction, I fully understand the challenge of local hard-hit areas trying to meet their 25% match, even if you get a FEMA federal declaration in an emergency. any money that would go into that fund and be available for that sort of thing, would that be in the form of a grant or a loan?
Madam Chair, when we proposed it during the special session, we proposed it as grants. The legislature actually decided otherwise and made it a loan. We think it ought to be a combination of both, yeah, because I think there are situations where grants are quite well in order, depending on circumstance, jurisdiction, size, capability. And there are other instances where we fully well know that if you gave a county, say, for instance, small county, a loan for a couple hundred thousand dollars and say you take 10 years to pay it off, they could absorb that over a 10-year period with zero interest, if you will, would be our proposal. I think it just makes good sense to make that kind of make that kind of investment for these folks, so they're not literally, in my own case, I remember such a thing where we didn't have a presidential deck, and we were borrowing money in the 80s when I was a county commissioner for 22.5% interest to pay our bills, and there was nobody at the state level that could offer us a helping hand. And I think we were clearly willing and able to pay it off, but it was about a third of our general fund budget just to get out of that one disaster. We had two of them back-to-back. Neither one reached the level of FEMA, so we couldn't get there from here. So we're borrowing money at 22.5%. I think we ought to be smarter than that, and that was 25 years ago. So we ought to be smarter than that, but we haven't got there since.
And I have a feeling our next presenters are going to have a little more to say on this particular subject as well. So are there specific questions for these two? Representative Mathis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a specific question about hazard mitigation. Early on, you showed us your organizational chart, and I know we can count on certain catastrophes happening in the state of Oregon, but you had three vacancies in the seismic area in terms of, I think it's bonds, engineer, and assistant. Mm-hmm. How does that impact the way that you're able to prepare or at least, you know, respond to the potential earthquakes? I mean, that's seismic accountability and everything else.
Chair Cowan, Representative Matthews, those three positions in the seismic program were only developed based upon President Courtney's efforts to put together the seismic rehabilitation program. They haven't been filled yet because there was not anything for them to do. We hired the program administrator, and they were really to deal with the actual program of seismic rehabilitation. So that's why those are vacant right now. And but the other side is we really have only two people available on my staff. One is an engineer, and another one is a hazard mitigation. Actually, the title is a state hazard mitigation officer. That's all we have on our staff to deal with any type of program with mitigation. So and right now we're these, as General Caldwell mentioned, they're working on projects from 5 or 8 years ago, and they're stretched pretty much to the max. I can tell you, if we get a presidential disaster declaration from the snowstorm, I'm not sure they can keep it up. We just don't have the staff to deal with it.
To kind of get to the point of your question, it's a chicken and egg thing on the seismic deal. If we don't have the money authorized by the legislature, the bonds to sell, they sell them and we have the money, there's really nothing for those three people to do. We weren't there yet. We're just about there. We've got a plan that we're presenting to the Ways and Means, who made it very clear that they wanted a plan by the end of this month, and it's being, the last draft is being scrubbed right now and should be this week. We'll present it to them in written format, and then they can proceed with bond sales. As those things take place, then those positions could be added back in and then be filled. There was no point in filling them and having them sit there waiting for all of this other effort to occur.
Thank you, sir.
Well, we'll see how that kind of rolls out. This committee may be interested in a bit of an update on where we are on the whole seismic questions. I believe a member among us has recently been appointed to the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Committee.
Yes.
And you'll learn to call that OSPAC because it's really hard to say the whole thing. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from the Oregon Emergency Management Association. thank you for coming today. Hopefully we can do this in about 20 minutes.
We will do.
That was a question. Thank you. Sort of.
I'm trying to get... somehow we ended up in the middle of the presentation.
Well...
have to go up here and hit. Am I good now?
Perfect. Thank you.
Madam Chair, you notice that a lot of these pictures in these presentations are in my district.
Can you click for me?
Yeah.
Cool.
The ones that aren't in my district.
The ones that aren't in your district.
Tell us anything about the coastal picture here. Yeah. Absolutely.
They're all on the same 2-mile stretch of road.
Okay. Are we ready?
We are.
Let's go then.
Chair Cowan, committee members, and committee staff, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. For the record, my name is Steve West. I am the Oregon Emergency Management Association government affairs person here in the building during the session. My own experience with emergency management started with 12 years in the electric utility industry, followed by 8 years as a county commissioner with responsibility for emergency management. I'm really pleased today to be joined by my colleague Jeff Sargent. Jeff is the incoming president of Oregon Emergency Management Association and has been charged by his board of directors with the task of being the liaison for government affairs. So Jeff's going to give you an overview of the association, and then I'm going to take just a few minutes and talk about our legislative priorities for this session. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for coming.
Chair Cowan, members of the committee, and staff, thank you for this opportunity to appear before you. For the record, my name is Jeff Sargent, representing Oregon Emergency Management Association. For my day job, I work with an organization, a federal government office called the Oregon Federal Executive Board, and our role is to encourage collaboration amongst federal government agencies in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Collaboration on common initiatives, and also to partner with federal, state, local, tribal, private sector, nonprofit organizations. My role with Oregon Emergency Management Association fits right in with our mission, and I'm pleased to represent the organization. My colleague Steve mentioned, we'll go through our presentation as quickly as possible because I know time is short. We'll essentially start with providing a very broad definition of emergency management. I recognize that many of you are well familiar with emergency management and, in fact, have even been involved in emergency response issues in your own jurisdictions. But just to kind of provide a foundation and share with you what our definition is, I'll quickly go through that and share some of the key components of emergency management. Then I'll move into explaining to you who Oregon Emergency Management Association is, how we differ from Ken's office, Oregon Emergency Management, what our role is, and some of the things that we do to support emergency managers and planners throughout the state. And then as we close, Steve will talk about some of our legislative priorities, and those are aligned very closely with the interests and needs of Oregon Emergency Management as well. Emergency management, essentially at its core, is a managerial function of an organization to create a framework within which communities can reduce the vulnerability of hazards. Emergency managers protect communities by coordinating and integrating activities to better prepare for and respond to natural disasters, man-made disasters, all hazards, essentially. The key components that our organization has adopted, and these were established by the International Association of Emergency Managers, so we are in alignment with them. The key components include that emergency management is comprehensive, and for the sake of time, I won't read through each one of these definitions. But
we are following along with the document
in front
of us, so that would be great.
Yes, comprehensive, progressive, it's risk-driven. Integrated, collaborative and coordinated, flexible and professional. Oregon Emergency Management, who are we and what is our role in the state? We are a statewide association of over 250 emergency management professionals. We are the practitioners throughout the state that Ken's organization, a state office, works with, supports. We are individuals that work at county, local level, regional, federal, fire departments, police departments, public health, hospitals, nonprofits, private sector. We just recently added over 30 private sector members to our entity as part of a partnership with a private sector working group that was founded in Oregon after Top Off 4 that was held in October of 2007 here in the state. So we have members now from Intel, Walmart, PacifiCorp, Pacific Power, Northwest Natural. So as you've heard over the past couple of years, that integration and partnership with the private sector is becoming more and more important, and we are in full support of that. We also, of course, have members of Ken's staff at Oregon Emergency Management as our members as well, and he has an open door to our organization and frequently comes to our quarterly meetings and provides updates to us. So we work very closely with them. Here's our mission. Committed to minimizing the impact of disasters in communities throughout Oregon. And our purpose. And again, I won't go through each one of these. You can see those on the sheet in front of you. But what you might expect for an emergency management association. Communication, training and education opportunities, influence public policy decisions, maintain professional standards. And our values. What do we do? We promote the efforts in Oregon's communities to plan for natural disasters and human-caused hazards. We provide emergency management professionals in the state the opportunity for network training, education. We also have a professional certification program here in the state, so emergency managers can enhance their professional standards. We provide a forum for sharing knowledge, best practices, build partnerships, also a collective and unified voice for emergency managers throughout the state, and that's part of why we're here today, and so we're, again, privileged to be here. We have quarterly meetings, and in fact, our next one will be held on February 18th here at the state as part of our legislative day, and we're very excited to be here, and I believe all of you received invitations, and we hope you'll have a chance to join us on that day. Following that, we'll have a spring training conference, as you can see here in Lincoln City, and our annual conference in partnership with the Washington State Emergency Management Association in September. And those are the fundamentals of our organization. I'll turn it over to Steve to talk a little bit about our legislative priorities.
You want to drive my slides?
Sure.
Thank you. Go ahead and bring up the first one. I'll take just a few minutes and talk about our legislative priorities for this session. Our first priority is for an Oregon Emergency Disaster Fund that has secure, dependable, and dedicated funding. Oregon Emergency Management Association supports an emergency disaster fund that has those components. Oregonians need and deserve an emergency disaster fund that has secure, dependable, and dedicated funding. The recent winter storms and flooding reinforce the ongoing need for those financial resources. Creative options should be explored to generate the much-needed funding. And the Oregon Emergency Disaster Fund needs to be flexible in the way it is administered and how funds are provided. That flexibility needs to include grants as well as loans, with the primary emphasis put on grants. It needs to be able to fund events that fall below the FEMA threshold. A county, a city, a jurisdiction can have an event that is a large magnitude to them, but yet it doesn't qualify for FEMA funding. And so the state fund would provide the resources that they could use for that. It could also be used to provide the 25% match when the event is of a magnitude that it makes the FEMA list, it makes a FEMA declaration. And it also should be able to be used for pre-emergency and disaster planning as well as mitigation. You've heard a lot, both from Ken Shop and others, talk about kind of the traditional 25-75 FEMA match. I can tell you that's not always the way it is. As a county commissioner, I saw a FEMA disaster that was a 90-10 match, 90% county, 10% FEMA. So that really emphasizes the need for us to have this funding available to the people of Oregon. Next slide, please. Before I leave that, too, I can also tell you from personal experience of being involved in a man-made disaster that bridged two states, the state of Oregon and the state of California. The state of California has an emergency fund. This was in 2001. And it was pretty hard to explain to the residents of Oregon why the people living across this line on the street, a state line, were receiving aid from their state when the Oregonians were not receiving any aid. So, again, there's lots of real-life examples of why this is important. Our second priority is for the seismic rehabilitation funding. Our association supports the $30 million in bonds for the seismic rehab of schools, hospitals, police stations, fire departments, as proposed in the governor's budget and recommended by the Oregon Emergency Management Agency. In the past two decades, Oregon has suffered severe damage causing seismic events. I think we all remember 1993. In March, there was the Scott Mills earthquake here in Marion County, a magnitude of 5.6 that did an estimated $25 to $30 million worth of damage, quite a bit of damage to this building that we're sitting in right now and required seismic upgrades. In September of that same year, my home county, Klamath County, suffered a 6.0 earthquake that at that time was estimated at $7.5 million damage and resulted in two deaths. Just a few months later, in December of that same year, there was what was considered an aftershock, but it was an aftershock of 5.4 magnitude that did considerable damage to buildings that had been pre-damaged, if you will, in that first earthquake. In addition, there's a variety of studies that have found widespread evidence that great earthquakes have occurred repeatedly in the past, and most recently, about 300 years ago, here in Oregon. And there's every reason to believe that a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake of a magnitude of 8 or greater will happen in our region, and it's probably not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. An earthquake of that magnitude would also create, no doubt, a large tsunami. And both of those disasters potentially result in significant destruction of buildings, infrastructure, and loss of life. The buildings that are most at risk are constructed of non-reinforced masonry and non-reinforced concrete. Many of those are public buildings like schools, hospitals, police and fire stations, and other government buildings. So again, that's why we support the governor's proposal for the $30 million in bonding. Go ahead. Our third priority is to increase the resources for the Oregon Emergency Management Agency. We support this because while demands for resources and services from the agency continue to increase, including the most recent winter storms and flooding, the department's budget is stagnant. The $2.8 million of general fund dollars that is in the current 2009-2011 proposed budget just funds status quo. The agency provides critical direct support to the local government emergency management efforts, both prior to and when emergencies and disasters strike. And in addition, the agency helps these entities prepare for disasters by providing valuable training, exercises, planning, and information resources. Pre-event planning and mitigation saves both money and lives, but it does require an upfront investment of resources and staff. Oregon Emergency Management, the agency, submitted a policy option package, several policy option packages for this 2009-2011 biennium budget for consideration that would have provided funding for much-needed staffing, but unfortunately, they were all rejected. The ever-increasing demands on the agency demonstrate the need for additional resources, including personnel, to support planning, mitigation, response, and recovery efforts statewide. Our association respectfully recommends that this committee and the state legislature work with Ken and his agency to identify and prioritize items that were in the policy option package that might still be included in the 2009-2011 budget. That concludes our presentation, and we'd be very happy to entertain any questions.
Questions for these presenters? As you have talked about establishing the disaster fund, and we were talking about a little earlier too, has your organization given any creative thinking to a source of funding for that?
I think one of the ideas that's been kicked around in the past that probably deserves looking at again is there may be some opportunities to partner with the insurance industry to put some kind of a fee, some kind of an adder on insurance policies. An example of that is the if you're familiar with the Oregon mapping program that came out of the Department of Revenue a few years ago, that was primarily funded by a surcharge, whatever you want to call it, a very small one. As I recall, it was like a dollar per document that was filed when the county clerks had to do a filing, mm-hmm. And that's how that program was funded. There may be something similar idea to explore with the insurance industry, where a flat fee, percentages get kind of iffy, but perhaps some kind of flat fee surcharge could be assessed on insurance policies in the state as a funding mechanism. So I guess the point of this is that we need to think out, you know, it becomes kind of an abused saying, but we need to think outside the box. The general fund, the pressure on the general fund at all levels of government is not getting any better, and so we need to look for creative ways to fund these kind of projects that are very worthwhile and necessary. I believe that the state of Florida has a similar program where they do work with the insurance industry to generate that funding.
There's so many of us floating around outside that box now that it's getting a little crowded. your association hasn't got any bill. You don't have any bills pending that we might be able to review in this committee?
No.
Okay. We're a little far into the session to start a real creative new discussion. So this may be something that we need to work together on as we move forward.
Certainly, Chair Cowan, I think part of the association's concern when we talk about additional resources for Oregon Emergency Management, the agency, is we just keep falling farther and farther behind.
Right.
And if we don't make some improvements in each budget cycle, the hope of ever making those improvements becomes a lot more dim. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot easier to come up with, again, as a county commissioner for 8 years and trying to balance a county budget, it's a lot easier to try to make those changes incrementally than it is to come back all at once and have to come up with a huge sum of money. And I just, it's a shame that the policy options that the agency submitted were all rejected. And it would sure be nice if at least maybe their highest priority in there, there could be some funding in this session.
Well, that was the reason I asked the director to bring back some numbers for us. Mm-hmm. The committee can take this up once again. I think it's an issue that's been tossed around for a while but hasn't really gained traction, at least in the time that I've been in this building. And so maybe we need to consider that interim kind of work group to begin to develop some more concrete ideas, much like the veterans organizations mm-hmm. did on the other side of this committee's responsibilities. So sort of throwing those thought processes out there is something maybe your organization might want to think about a little bit.
And the commitment that I will make for the association is that I am sure that they would like to be a part of that. Well, I would like to help. A big part of us being so pleased to be here today is we want to get on your radar screen. We want you to know that we exist. The association is over 50 years old, and we really feel that we can be a great resource to you, and we partner very closely with the state agency, but we are different and are often confused with them, which is not a bad lot to be confused with. They're great people. But we just want you to know that there is a professional association in the state made up of emergency managers, and they're dedicated to that business, and hope that you will have time on our February 18th legislative day, that you'll have a minute to poke your head into. We're going to be downstairs in HR 50 and just take a few minutes and maybe share some of your thoughts with the association members.
I'm sure that we'll try to do that. Any other questions? You have three out of the four are the same letters, so it's understandable for the confusion then. So.
As a representative of the executive board, I just want to, for the record, share our appreciation for the work you do through this committee in supporting the men and women who are the professional emergency managers throughout this state. They work very hard, of course, to try to mitigate the and minimize the impacts of disasters, and anything that you can do and what you have done already is of great assistance, so we appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Maybe I'm just going to take a couple of minutes. I wanted to make you aware that on Thursday's agenda, there's kind of a unique request that we're going to hear for a local area emergency declaration pre-disaster. We see it coming, we're trying to figure out what to do about it. And so I asked Paul Evans, are you willing to just kind of maybe give the committee a little bit of an idea what the thinking is that goes into this presentation and what direction we might be asking of the committee as a result.
Yes, ma'am.
Anytime
you ask.
Spur of the moment, I did not give him any warning, or at least not more than an hour, so this is off the top of his head.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Paul.
Anytime, anything we can do to help. Chair Cowan, members of the committee, again, my name is Paul Evans. I'm the policy advisor for Governor Kunkowski on military emergency management and veterans issues. The question at hand, having to do with the Port of Newport and their unique situation, it's one of those, we've been trying to figure out a frame to explain it by. It's not just mitigation, because the leaking is already occurring and we can see the threat, but it hasn't quite gotten to the point where life safety is there imminent, but it will be unless we're careful. And there are a number of things that I think are going to be talked about on Thursday. And conceptually, what really I think is the best way to approach it is very similar to what was done for the salmon in terms of a disaster. There is precedent for a declaration of disaster for something that is not a 24-hour cycle kind of emergency, but yet has the same impact after it occurs. And what that does is if, for example, if the Port of Newport went through the county and asked for a state declaration, and concurrently this body felt it important enough to make an issue, to make it a priority, the governor, if we could get to that point of the threshold, the governor could sign it into as a declaration of emergency and actually free up state resources for creative thinking, potentially free up different pots of money. This morning we were actually trying to identify different potential pots of money that could be there. And I would argue that, and let me rephrase, I'm not promising because I don't necessarily have the say on how the money is spent, but I would argue that the recovery fund, as it currently is right now, it's really not big enough to do a lot of the things that we would like to do with it, but it is big enough that it might help in this particular situation, and it might help a local community in a tough spot. So it might be one of those things that should be considered by that type of fund. There are also, in talking with happened to be the fire day today, so I talked to the state fire marshal's office about their hazmat funds. And I believe once it's declared a disaster, if it's declared a disaster, that actually allows potentially to look into, at least for this winter immediate concern of leakage over the rough seas, potentially some funds for that. I also recommend discussions with DEQ about potential pots of money. All of this, however, is really predicated on the idea that a case can be made, which I think there is a case for, that the urgency of the situation is in fact itself an emergency, even if it doesn't meet traditional definitions of a fire, a flood, or things like that. The potential contamination risk to life and the bay and potential economic impact, I think, is both provable and a unique enough circumstance that it would meet that test. Again, I can't promise those things, but it seems to me that it is similar to the salmon model. So I don't know if that helps.
I appreciate that. I just wanted to lay a little groundwork. I'm going to let the Port of Newport director, who will be on our agenda next week, explain the actual situation, and I'm sure you'll have pictures for everybody, but there are some aging hulls of old barges that
right.
were used as part of the dock, and they are disintegrating, and there's a plan. There's been a bond measure down the road for this to be taken care of, but the movement has been so significant that apparently early in the morning when it's very quiet, you can actually hear movement within these vessels, and the crack is getting very big. They've moved about an inch and a half. I think he's got better detail than I, and we're all very worried about the potential of this giving way this winter in the winter storms before we can get to the project. And so if there's a way to do something to protect from that, it may be helpful to have this
yes,
designation so that we can work through some other processes. But this is an unusual situation, and I wanted you to be prepped so it didn't kind of just hit you. We don't need to debate it right now.
No, ma'am. If I could, just for one thing, at Chair Cowan and members of the committee, in the model of emergencies and in the traditional definition of how we've approached things, Americans generally tend to look at a situation, get the job done, and then it's over. And we now are in a world where, in many cases, the federal government won't have the capacity to do a lot of things that maybe it could have in the past. So, arguably, this is a perfect example to, through action, to begin that policy discussion, that greater policy discussion of when those situations arise that are between normal mitigation and life crisis emergency, but there's an exigency of clear evidence and a disaster that will occur, it makes sense, rational sense, to try to buy down the cost of the eventual emergency through swift action. And I look forward to this policy discussion and to do everything that we can through emergency management and the state agencies.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I believe we're... Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
This is kind of a housekeeping item. Some of us here have gone paperless, and if we could have this stuff emailed to the administrator, then
okay.
they could be forwarded to us, and we could get that on our computers, and then we wouldn't have to have paper. We'd really appreciate that.
As a paper-dependent person, I didn't even think of that, so thank you. And if all the presenters could email that to the administrator and get it out to selected members of this committee, that would be great. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned.
Also, I committed to less paper, not paper.